Hello and welcome to 100% Real with Ruby. Today I have the Alan Aragon back again because, come on, I mean, when it comes to nutritional science and that science placed into practicality where it makes sense to anyone and everyone, where it kind of... it brings trolls along because it kind of hurts the feelings of people that try to come up with something fancy because they have their shirts off and they look like they know what they're talking about, but most of the time they don't. It's not like there's no one else except Alan that kind of lays it out there, lays the facts, and actually makes it really fun and interesting because he makes us laugh along with it. Everyone already knows who Alan is, but with that, maybe you can kind of brush up on some of the more recent things that have come into your media in terms of the carnivore diet is taking a rise again. The keto is always there. So what is the spiel on the carnivore diet and these diet camps? Because there's veganism picking up in popularity and carnivore. So where should we fall? What does the science say?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure, Ruby. And you always just deliver hardcore on your end too. So thank you right back. What I've been seeing is sort of this perpetual song that people sing about their favorite diet. And it's usually an emotion-based position rather than a science and evidence-based position. Because people are just very emotionally attached to what works for them personally. Furthermore, it's human nature to only be able to think in simple terms. Like, we try to process information by sticking things into binary black or white categories. So we're gravitating towards extremes. It's just human nature. People want the magic bullet. And it's either one thing on one end of the extreme or it's the other thing on the other end of the spectrum. So there are people who gravitate towards either militant veganism or militant plant-phobic, plant-free carnivore type dieting. And honestly, it just makes things easier for people to think. It's a rule that people follow. And furthermore, there is a distrust of science and research that pervades, well, you know, mostly the carnivore side of the coin. They just say, oh, yeah, well, look what happened with, and it gets political as well on both sides. So they go, yeah, ooh, safe and effective, my butt, you know, so we're just forget about it. I'm just going to sit here, eat my ribeye. Maybe put some butter on it and then just call it a lifestyle. So that's what I'm seeing. People just gravitate towards extremes. And it's hard for people to grasp the concept that life is not black or white. There is almost this infinitely graduated gray scale. And this is what people don't like to hear. They don't like to hear about nuance. They don't like to hear about the shades of gray. They want do this or do that. So that's kind of the general thing I'm seeing. And it's very common. And I don't think it's going to go away anytime soon.
I like the fact that you ended with that you don't think it's going to go away anytime soon. We do it with everything. If you can't do the hardcore version of it all, then not at all. But I also find that a lot of people find it easier to stick to food rules than they do to quote-unquote moderation. But moderation isn't just a blanket statement. It's how can you make moderation work for you? Because even that falls on a sliding scale. And I, in Facebook groups especially, it's almost like people just parrot what someone else says because it seems some sort of logical. There's MDs, neuroscientists, and people with doctor in neuroscience saying things that seem like they could be plausible. How can we know what's right and wrong when people with doctor are saying the very same things?
I think it's, you can safely disregard the information from somebody who uses words like always or never or avoid this, this is a bad food, avoid this, while they're deifying other foods, like while they're painting this health halo around certain foods and telling you just avoid this and this and that, avoid it. So the more somebody scaremongers, the safer it is to just dismiss what the heck they're saying. Like, for example, if somebody is in a grocery store and they're going down the aisle and they pull something out and say, see this, look at this. Ooh, look at that. Look at that. You got to avoid this. This is going to kill you. La, 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 la. Dismiss everything. They're quacks. And that's one hack. That's an information hack to know when you're looking at a quack, somebody complaining about stuff in a grocery store.
So then if that's the case, a lot of the things that they point out in grocery stores are things like seed oils, things like GMOs and glycophosphate and
glyphosate, yeah.
That thing, and natural versus non-natural. What is the truth behind seed oils and GMOs while we're at it?
Yeah, those are great questions. The seed oil question is something that takes a little bit of patience to deal with the explanation. So we can start with saying that seed oils are bad is the equivalent of saying dairy is bad or meat is bad. And so that should give you the hint that seed oils are not this single monolith. They're a diverse group of foods with widely varying biological effects. And so you can't, when you say seed oils are bad, you're already screwing up by making an oversimplification. And so the question becomes, what seed oil and what dose and what context, what circumstances? And then when you ask people that, their entire claim starts falling apart. They start Googling. They start Googling, what's the worst seed oil? And then they come back with, oh, okay, canola, gotcha, canola. All right, cool. Send me the human study or any human study that shows a harmful effect from eating canola oil. And then you get crickets. And then you just get more and more crickets as it goes from there. And so people don't understand that when you make a claim that something is bad, okay, do you have an evidence basis for it? Or did you just read it on a blog in the internet? Did you just hear that through the gym locker gossip rumor mill? And it's usually they heard it through the rumor mill, they read it on a blog, or they saw some guru say it, or they saw some doctors say it. And then when they're put to task of, all right, could you link the human research showing harm? They quickly find out that this is not so easy to do.
So when it does come to seed oils, what is the actual truth behind it? And why can we actually include seed oils into our diet? I would also want to bring in here, because there is this misinformation. Well, it's misconstrued, the whole omega-3 versus omega-6s, where in literature, omega-6s are shown to be anti-inflammatory in themselves. It's just like you said, it's like saying dairy is bad. Okay, but a lot of processed foods come with highly hydrogenated fats and things that are bad for our blood health. But that's not to say that all omega-6s are bad. And one of the very first things that I got introduced to when I started my nutrition education is how great flaxseed oil is for you. But that has the word seed in it. Is it all of a sudden going to just like put me into hospital or something?
See, and that illustrates my point, Ruby, that when you say something like seed oils are bad, okay, well, how about this? Find me something bad about chia seeds and human consumption. Find me, like, bring me some systematic reviews, some meta-analyses of health outcomes related to flaxseed intake. What are we seeing? What are we seeing with chia seeds? What are we seeing with flaxseeds? What are we seeing with sesame seeds? Oh, guess what? We're seeing all positive, favorable health outcomes, and a wide range of them. So what happened to your seed oils are bad thing? Oh, well, gosh, have you seen those YouTube videos or how those seed oils are produced? Have you seen that? Oh, boy. Then you have to steer them back and say, look, we can take a look at your diet right now and go through the manufacturing processes of every single one, and you'd probably faint. But beyond that, we have to judge a food not on how, in quotes, unnatural it is, because then you're giving into the appeal to nature. If you were to say that more natural equals better, then you would have to include foods like blowfish, hemlock. You know, you're free to eat hemlock and blowfish, all natural, but you'll die instantly. And so people are, they fall victim to the appeal to nature fallacy, or the, some people incorrectly call it the naturalistic fallacy, but it's an appeal to nature that appeals to people's emotions. They think that, the closer it is to nature, people have this idea that just because something requires a certain set of processes in order for it to be fit for human consumption, then they go, oh yeah, well, it's, this food has been engineered, this food has been manufactured somehow, and therefore it's bad for you. No, that's not true. It's only bad for you if it adversely affects measurable parameters of human health. And so in this, these range of parameters we can look at, there are the hard endpoints, the hardcore, the so-called concrete or hard endpoints, like death, like disease, like cardiac events. You know, we can follow those things, or we can look at the steps that lead there, or the intermediate endpoints, intermediate parameters or outcomes, like changes in blood lipid, changes in glucose tolerance, changes in any number of elements on the blood panel. We can look at those things too. So when you apply seed oils to this battery of assessments, not only are they safer in terms of lowering cardiometabolic risk factors like glucose control, blood lipids, insulin sensitivity, they are also safer in terms of lowering risk for the hard endpoints like cardiac disease, cardiac events, death, cancer, diabetes. So all along the spectrum of parameters, seed oils outperform things like butter, lard, beef fat. So look, how easy and fun would it be to be able to point to seed oils as the thing that's killing us? I would be the first to do it if the evidence was there, but the evidence actually shows that they're no worse and oftentimes better for health than the animal fats that people use to cook with. And I'm talking about land animal fats, because, you know, fish fats typically show favorable health effects.
Yeah, and I guess this can kind of go back to the introduction where we brought in the animal meats. Do you see long-term carnivore impacting any of those actual health parameters, or red meats, or literally any animal product in general? Because I know you get riled up just as much as me when you see Netflix documentaries popping up, because they tend to be vegan propaganda. And then people start fearing all of these things that they never once had a problem with before.
So there's a complicated answer to that, Ruby, as with everything.
I love complicated answers.
Well, the complicated answer to that carnivore question is, carnivore tends to, especially when the general population who is used to consuming the standard Western diet, getting on carnivore tends to increase protein intake and remove the carb fat based, highly refined and processed junk food. It tends to remove that. And so there's a few things going on at the same time. Number one, people are losing body weight and body fat pretty rapidly when they go carnivore, because they're essentially getting on a ketogenic diet that is devoid of the extra calories that would come from plant foods in themselves. And so they're typically going on an accelerated version of the ketogenic diet. So they're losing body weight and body fat very rapidly. And so whenever you lose excess body fat, by whichever way you do it, this in and of itself is going to impart profound reductions in cardiometabolic risk. And so, but there's a simultaneous thing that's going on at the same time, is that when people go hard with the carnivore diet and they go hard with thinking that, oh, hey, I can just eat meat and eat half sticks of butter and, you know, all the rest of that. And then they end up initiating processes at the vascular level that take years and decades to manifest adversely. And so they're winning in one sense, in that they're reducing body fat and they're improving body composition, but they're losing in the other sense, in that they are putting their cardiovascular health at risk. It's the lesser of the evils, but it's still a suboptimal and risky diet nevertheless. But people don't want to hear that. They want to hear, what do I need to cut out? Make it real simple, make it real extreme. Oh, no plants, no plant food. Plants are trying to kill me. Good, perfect. I can do this. So that's the problem. That's the problem with it.
That's the screenshot I sent you. And that was said by a doctor of neuroscience as well, just to clear it out there. And that these, like, doctors in themselves, like your general practitioner, they don't study nutrition. Neuroscientists don't study nutrition. They study the brain. And it's when you think that just because someone has a doctor by their name, that everything they say is going to be a fact, or that there's a book that has PhD slapped on the front, it doesn't mean that what is in there is going to be factual. Because PhD in what? Doctor in what? You need to dilate that down. You brought up a really important point, and like veganism, carnivorism, they can both be taken to extremes that are extremely bad for you, because I know vegans that have the worst, but the best place to be is in that gray area, in the middle, where most of your diet is plant food with animal meats on top, because that is like, you're not just eating protein when you eat meat. You are getting a lot of other vitamins and minerals with those animal products. But the whole like cutting out the processed crap is the part I loved that you said, because there is this myth of a slowing metabolism and dieting ruining your metabolism. But the thing is that weight loss in itself does induce adaptive thermogenesis in both females and males, but we're talking about females. But females somehow adapt harder, and that's usually a behavioral thing at the same time that we respond to stress differently. But the metabolic adaptation isn't really as great as we're made to believe it is. It's usually our behaviors that have changed that make our metabolism slow down, and it doesn't just ruin our metabolism. Because then we blame dieting, or we blame our hormones, or we blame the fact that we're aging, or we're now mums that we can't lose weight. So what is the science behind that?
Yeah, those are really good points. And there's a lot of controversy surrounding the topic of metabolic adaptation. But fortunately, there's been a lot of investigation recently on bottom line, like how much metabolic adaptation or adaptive thermogenesis, adaptive thermoreduction actually happens as a result of dieting, you know. And it turns out that it's not as dramatic as we would want to assume. You know, it comes down to less than 100 calories a day decrease in resting metabolic rate. It's usually like 50 to 60 calories reduced in resting metabolic rate. When you account for things like lean body mass loss and the loss of metabolically active tissue. So then after you account for all of those things and you account for decreases in activity, both voluntary physical activity and subconscious non-exercise activity decreases, then this margin of metabolic adaptation, where your resting metabolic rate slows beyond what would be predicted from the loss of metabolically active tissue, comes down to a very kind of piddly amount of calories, like I said, 50 to 60 calories. Now, with that said, there are certain exceptions. Physique competitors, for example, recently were shown by Isola and colleagues to have experienced a decrease in resting metabolic rate of about 10%. This is above and beyond what would be predicted by losses in like lean mass. So that 10%, we're looking at like 150 or 200 calories of, in quotes, metabolic adaptation at the end of this 3 to 6 month dieting phase. So if you take leanness to an absolute extremes, then you're looking at as much as 150-ish calories, sometimes close to 200 calories or so, decrease in resting metabolic rate that gets lost to the monster of metabolic adaptation. But in the general population, this amount is about a third of that. Most of the decrease that happens comes from physical activity. And most of that physical activity decrease doesn't come from exercise activity decrease. It comes from non-exercise activity thermogenesis, where you just subconsciously are moving a lot less. And so when you combine the decrease in non-exercise activity with that small amount of metabolic adaptation, then it can kind of add up, especially when you combine that with misreporting and unreported binging episodes. So that all of that adds up in the body being very defensive, both behaviorally, mostly behaviorally, and a little bit physiologically defensive against the dieting process.
This kind of goes back to our very first podcast where I explained exactly what weight loss resistance is, and Alan kind of went deeper into the topic of weight loss resistance, in that the fact it's not your body that's being resistant. It is your mindset. It is your psychology. It is your behaviors, because you are a sum of your habits. And as your habits start to slow down, as you start to slow down, as does your metabolism. But that's because you slowed down. And that's the same when people say, my age is preventing me from getting to the body that I want to get to. Aside from the fact that we typically slow down, sometimes we tend to not push ourselves the same way in our training, when we know that training is what builds the body that we want. Without the training, you're not going to have the muscle definition that you want. You can fat loss yourself all the way that you want, but you are putting yourself at a high risk of muscle loss, which is when you will adapt harder. You are putting yourself at a higher risk of getting into these tendencies, like you said, with the binging, in that you're adapting to a smaller engine during the week. You're underfueling your activity. This is my most passionate topic, so I want to dig deeper into the literature with you here. This is where you're underfueling your most active state through the day to maybe binge at night, or your most active week where you're training, where you're doing things that are conducive to building the body that you want. But then when you end up overeating on the weekend, it's not typically foods that enhance your metabolism, your hormones, your muscle, which is whole foods, fruits, veg, and protein. It is usually pizza or tacos, anything else that is highly palatable that takes you over into a surplus. So even though your calories may be around the same that whole week, they're not the same. They are not the same in that context. You could be putting yourself into a surplus, which is where your maintenance and why you say that you're eating X amount of calories, but you're not losing weight, but you're not seeing the changes that you want. But are your behaviors reflecting that? And this is kind of where that whole deflated maintenance versus what is your real maintenance comes in. Because a lot of people can eat a lot more than they realize. But sadly, most people are already eating a lot more than they realize.
Yep, that is very true. And it is entirely possible for people to deceive themselves into thinking that they're following their diet, when the reality is they're following their diet, like, let's say 80, 90%, doing pretty good, 5 days a week. And if they're shooting for, let's say, an average of 500 calorie deficit a day or 3,500 calorie deficit a week, I got to say, it's pretty easy over the course of a weekend to eat up that 3,500 calorie deficit over the course of going out twice for dinner. So you're talking drinks, appetizers, main course, desserts, random snacking on 2 days out of the week. And it's very, very common to be able to just stamp out that caloric deficit. And then at the end of the month, you go, damn, nothing happened. Like, what happened? I was doing great most of the time. I was nailing the diet most of the time. So you have to be really careful about the times that you are letting go of the reins, because it's really easy to eat up that deficit.
Yeah, and going back to that whole NEAT concept, which is the activity that you do outside of the gym, it really does add up. And this is kind of why it does my head in when people talk about, actually, this is a good place to bring in the science of reverse dieting as well. But it really does my head in when people talk about, it's people like you, because I was trying to explain that reverse dieting isn't real, that you don't increase your calories 50 at a time. And there is no such thing, because I put a post up, you can explain the science of this too, that there is no such thing as eating so little that your body won't lose weight. And they're like, well, it's people like you that make us reverse diet people in the first place. Well, no, you really aren't eating that little and not losing weight. It's the fact that because you're so restricted, either your movement is extremely restricted, or you're exercising so much that you're tiring yourself out and not able to do anything else outside of the gym. You might be moving your feet quite okay-ish, but outside of that, you might be a friggin' starfish. And on top of that, what about the crusts you forgot from your kid's lunch and the extra chicken nugget that you had with the dinner? Like, it might not seem like a lot, but if you are a small female, you might only be maintaining on 1400 calories if you dieted down that low, meaning any, like, all these little things, if you truly are eating 1200, 1300 calories in a quote unquote deficit, those little things do add up over time. And being sedentary and a small female, sadly, doesn't give you that much of a space. So what is the reality and science of that?
Yeah, I just came across a really interesting study. Let me see if I can pull it over here.
I love
here.
It when
so,
you love studies, because it really explains it to people.
Yeah, this is a really, really cool eye-opening thing. So this is a study that was done in 2022, so it's a really recent study, and it shows. Okay, well that's a whole other study. This is all interesting stuff to me. Okay, so this study over here, is called Resting Metabolic Rate of Obese Patients Under a Very Low Calorie Ketogenic Diet, and by very low calorie, we're talking about 600 to 800 calories a day on a keto diet. And they actually did not experience any significant metabolic adaptation that would not be predicted by drops in lean body mass. And it's super interesting, because they reported their resting metabolic rates of these subjects. So their body weights, so total body weight at the start of the 4 month trial was 95.9 kilograms. And by the end of the trial, it was roughly 70 kilograms. And so 76 kilograms. And so they lost a substantial amount of weight. but their resting metabolic rate, their decrease in resting metabolic rate, was wholly explainable by decreases in lean body mass. And so resting metabolic rate at baseline was 1,978 calories. Resting metabolic rate at the end of the 4 months of an excruciating 800 calorie keto diet was 1,776 calories a day. That was their resting metabolic rate. And so this is very common. Some people think that, oh, I won't lose weight on 1,200 calories or 1,000 calories or whatever it is, that people think that, oh, I'm maintaining 100 kilograms or 90 kilograms on 1,200. Okay, you might think that that's the case, but every time we put subjects under the microscope and examine their resting metabolic rate objectively, it just still, it's never that low that people are claiming. And so now, granted, you can take somebody who's a very small person and theoretically they could have a resting metabolic rate of 1,000 calories or less. However, when you're looking at people who have a high degree of obesity and they are claiming a very low caloric intake, what they're actually probably misestimating is what their average intake is over the course of the week, and they miss these ebbs and flows, these highs and these dips that skew their average way up. And there is research, some classic research. I think it was 1992. And this is a study that I bring up all the time because the results are very illuminating. And yeah, it was 1992. So it's Lichtman and colleagues. And the name of the study is Discrepancy Between Self-Reported and Actual Caloric Intake and Exercise in Obese Subjects. And what they did was they examined a group of obese subjects, the history of thyroid medication use, and with a self-proclaimed diet resistance. And they locked them under surveillance and did their interventions and found out that these individuals were underreporting caloric intake on average by 47%. And they were overestimating or overreporting their habitual physical activity by 51%. And what that amounts to is over 1,000 calories that were unaccounted for in terms of what they reported. So, I mean, this could be reflective of a large segment of the dieting population where they don't purposely lie to their trainers or their coaches, but they just truly do not have a grip on the reality of what's going on.
I love so many things you said in there. I don't even know where to start. The first part is where you said these obese people where they were put onto a very low calorie diet and they still lost weight. So it wasn't the fact that their metabolism was slow. It was obvious that when they were put into a monitored, because it was a study, it was very closely monitored. They were put mm-hmm. into a monitored environment where they had to eat X amount of calories and that was monitored. They lost weight. So it isn't about your hormone balancing and fixing my gut health and have this Bloom's drink. It's what are you actually eating and what is your movement like? Because that 1 hour in the gym doesn't burn all that much. And the second part of that, which I love, because I also want to bring in carbs because you know how much I love them, muscle. And its importance of no matter what phase you are in, muscle is the most important thing that you need to build if you care about a lean physique, because most of the time it's more muscle you need versus more fat you need to lose. For the people that listen to my podcast that are more of the average build, that last little bit of fat is just muscle that you need. And it's going to change your entire physique. Instead of, this is a tangent, but it needs to be said, instead of trying to lose that last 3 to 8 pounds, if you actually focused on building another 2 to 4, 5, 6 pounds of muscle, which isn't really your muscle because then you have to take into account the water and the glycogen and the food volume, you will look like a completely different body composition of you, because that equals more hardness, more fullness, and that will make you look leaner with a lower body fat percentage at the same weight. You will look leaner at the same body fat percentage. And if you lose muscle in a dieting process, which I know you can bring in a study here as well, but if you lose muscle in the dieting process, when you come back, you are going to gain a crap ton of fat back because your hunger is going to be elevated. You are more predisposed to gain back fat because your body's going to be like, I'm missing something here, and that is lean muscle tissue. You're going to have to gain back as much weight back until you regain that lean muscle back. But this is also where I would say carbs are essential to prioritize in a fat loss phase, because you want to protect your muscle like anything. You want to protect your energy like anything. You want to protect your training performance like anything. If you are going to deplete yourself of the energy, the carbs, you are going to walk around like a zombie for most of the day as your calories get lower. Your performance in the gym is going to go down. Your ability to build muscle and perform and keep your strength up is going to go down. So if you care about your energy, your performance, and looking like the athlete you say you want to looking like the fit person you say you want to look like, then I would care about how you fuel your day, not just your training, and muscle. I remember reading this in one of your Alan Aragon reviews, because when I read things, I remember them when there's visuals, and there was a visual of how you train to keep the muscle is how you train to build it. And there was a little volume graph as well. Maybe you can talk a little bit more about, like I mentioned, what happens when you lose muscle or when you don't train to build muscle, to keep muscle, and the science behind training for fat loss.
Yeah, well, just kind of going through the things that you covered there, there is a phenomenon called that the researchers call collateral fattening. It's an odd term where the body at the end of a dieting cycle, if you lose a lot of lean body mass, then your hunger hormones are higher than they would have been if you preserved your lean body mass during the fat loss phase. And so what happens when you diet away a lot of body fat, but also a lot of meat, then the body senses an imminent threat to survival. So it senses an energy crisis. And so therefore hunger hormone production is elevated. Your appetite is more raging. And like you mentioned, you really are setting yourself up just hormonally, behaviorally for quick rebound. And you're going to gravitate towards foods that get this done the most efficiently. So energy dense, hyper palatable types of foods, junk foods, is usually what people gravitate towards. And so this is kind of what underlies the yo-yo dieting phenomenon, is when people diet for a time period, they don't reasonably keep their lean body mass. I mean, sometimes lean body mass, it's inevitable to decrease some of it if you've gained a ton of it while getting overweight enough. But if you lose an excessive amount of lean body mass and you did not gain any sort of behavioral skills along the way during your dieting journey, you didn't gain any skills of countermeasures that would mitigate maladaptive eating behaviors. And of course, if you learned a bunch of bro science and weird stuff about magic foods and evil foods, then at the end of the diet, you're at a bad spot. You are primed and ready to just regain all the weight because you're frustrated. You're eating all of the right foods and you're still, you know, or what you think are the right foods, but you're still just hungry. And the cycle really catapults you right back to a bad spot and beyond. And so that's the phenomenon of collateral fattening, where you end up at a fatter spot than you began because you lost a bunch of lean mass while you were dieting. And the other thing that you were mentioning, this is a few steps back when you were talking about reverse dieting. There's a myth that reverse dieting will automatically increase your, in quotes, metabolism, or increase your metabolic capacity. And it does do that, but only to the extent that you increase lean body mass and you increase exercise energy expenditure. So you have to increase those two departments of energy expenditure in order for reverse dieting to actually work like it's supposed to. So I just wanted to make sure that I touched on that thing, because people think that I'll reverse diet and then my maintenance calories will be like 1,000 calories more than they used to be. Okay, it's possible for that to happen, but along with the increases in your caloric intake, there has to be increases in lean mass, and there has to be, and usually it's both, there has to be increases in training output. Otherwise, a reverse diet will not work. And I am not against reverse diets. I think that it's a great idea to increase what researchers call energy flux. Because a lot of times, low energy flux types of scenarios are really what's keeping people overweight or overfat. And if you can just increase energy flux, then you can increase lean mass and improve body composition without incurring these issues with hunger. So yeah, it could get a little complicated, but I don't want to overcomplicate it.
That last part was important, without the increases in hunger. And I think I've had a couple of different clients in particular. I'm going to explain both of them, where they said that reverse dieting didn't work. One of them was the one that did reverse dieting. The reverse dieting way in increasing calories only a little bit. And she said she only gained fat. And the reason for that was she wasn't really sticking to the reverse diet, because she dieted, she lost a bunch of her weight. But then as soon as she ended her diet, all of a sudden, buffet effect. She just wanted to keep on eating. She was tracking the food according to her calories that she was given, but she wasn't tracking everything she was eating. And she was so hyper fixated on how she was failing it that it was taking away from the things that she could be doing, like using that energy towards training, towards more energy in life. In fact, it didn't even give her that, because she wasn't planning for a higher intake of food, just little baby steps. And the other one was just thinking, okay, cool, I can increase my food this much. But like you said, never took into consideration, okay, well, are you moving more? No. In the past, she was told you need to cut all your cardio out, bring down your excessive steps, and just eat more food. Okay, so you're going to bring down your activity and you're going to increase your food. What do you think is going to happen from there? It doesn't make sense.
But exactly. And sometimes people do need a break from program, like they need a psychological break from it, and I think that's legitimate. A lot of times prospective clients come to us having on and off just struggled with dieting for years and feeling like they've been chronically dieting for either months or years, and just restricting, and so and going through periods of high training volume, high training output, trying to hit 10K steps a day while doing, formal cardio and resistance training on top of that and dieting. It's like, all right, so why don't we go through a break? Why don't we do a structured break where you will have to be psychologically fine with gaining some weight, because we're going to try to pull everything back and give you a psychological break. And you need that psychological break. If you just try to push forward without taking a break, then you're probably going to keep getting the same level of frustration that you've been getting. So let's take a break, gain some body fat, learn how to look at foods differently, and hey, pull back the training volume too. And then after you've taken enough of a break, then we can reassess and see what approach you want to take to initiating a progress phase before you take another break. And I think that people underestimate the effectiveness or the power of taking a break. And people underestimate the power of knowing that it's okay to gain a little bit of body fat periodically, just to sort of take a vacation from the program. But more than that, a lot of people who've been chronically dieting, they've never valued maintenance phases. They've never been taught the value of, hey, you've lost, let's imagine you've lost 20 pounds. That's a lot of weight to lose. Let's say somebody lost 25 pounds. Sometimes you have to explain to them, I know you want to lose 50 pounds, but you're halfway there. And the 25 pounds that you lost, if you can imagine every gallon, picture a gallon jug of milk, all right? Imagine it filled with butter. Okay, that's 8 pounds of fat per gallon of milk, all right? So picture three of those, just picture them sitting next to each other. You lost three of those. If you've lost 25 pounds of fat, and a lot of times people lose sight of the reality that in order for you to lose that much fat, you really have to fundamentally change your psychology and your physiology, and even even fundamental infrastructure of your circulatory system or your neurological system, because you're no longer supporting that body fat, and even biomechanically things are different. And so I think that people don't give themselves enough credit for the amount of progress they made, and they want to, and they see themselves as being halfway successful, so they're still not winning the game. And when somebody is at that place psychologically, I think it helps to bring them back down to earth and say, hey, look, you lost, let's say they only lost like 8 pounds. Just say, hey, get a gallon of milk, look at it, picture it filled with butter. You have removed that from your body, like for good. That's a big deal. And so therefore we just keep moving forward. Now I'm going to challenge you to, let's go back to the person who lost three of those gallon jugs of fat from their body. I want to challenge you to hold this for another month. I want to challenge you to hold this for another 2 or 3 months. Let's see if you can do it. Let's see if this change is actually permanent. And keep in mind that a lot of people have taken somewhere between 10 to 20 years to accumulate their excess body fat. So if somebody is frustrated at 3 months or even 6 months, you have to bring them back down to earth and say, hey, look, you're expecting to make these fundamental changes in your physiology and your psychology inside of a few months. It's not going to happen. You know, you took 10 to 20 years to put this fat on. If we take a year to get it off and make the behavioral changes necessary, then you've totally won. And so I think that when people kind of gain a little bit more perspective of the long term, I think it helps them sort of see how silly it is when when they think that they haven't made much progress, or when they think that, oh gosh, you know, this, in quotes, this reverse diet, I can't deal with it because I'm or this maintenance phase, I can't deal with it because I've gained like 2 to 3 pounds back. That's perfectly fine. I think people can gain 1 to 2% of their body weight back during a maintenance phase, and it's worth the psychological break that they're taking. And I know I'm going on and on here, but a colleague of mine, a friend of mine named Paul Nobles, runs a program where his clients spend more time in maintenance than they do in dieting phases. And so, and that's a really interesting paradigm, and actually a really attractive paradigm for certain populations who have spent most of their lives trying to diet. So, like, what Paul does is he cuts off people's dieting phases at like 4 to 6 weeks, and then he has them maintained for 2 to 3 months, and then, you know, he repeats the cycle. And so their maintenance time is like double and triple the length of their dieting time. And for people who don't have a show to do or a photo shoot to do or a film that they're going to do or a way they need to look within X number of weeks, I think it can be a good idea to try to shift people's mental set, you know, their mindset from, okay, I got to diet, and take these little breaks every now and then, to, okay, let's see if I can go through a dieting phase, and then let's see if I can maintain it for a substantial period, and let's see if I can manage that maintenance phase properly. And ultimately, you want to be able to manage maintenance properly. So I really like the idea of incorporating those maintenance phases.
God damn, you just started the main course. Like this, I am all about time away from fat loss. And especially for my audience, most of you listening to this need way more time away from maintenance, because the body you think you want is not made in fat loss. Yes, it's going to trim off some of the fluff, but you can't ever see that result that you want once you trim off any fluff there, if you can even trim it off, because like we said, the weight loss resistance is due to diet fatigue. It's due to you only placing your value on either how little you can eat, but mostly on the scale going down, trying to stay under a certain number. As soon as the scale goes up, because you're scared of it going up in maintenance, or you think that as soon as it goes up, it means that you failed, or the only way you measure success is when you're moving towards a leaner body through dieting. That's when you lose the wheels off your choo-choo train and fall off the track, because the track is life and the life is incorporating maintenance in it. And you need to learn that your maintenance is your house. You can't spend so much time away from your house. You need to build the house. Fat can't be lost all at once. It's in phases. Sure, if you want to string it out over 2 years and accumulate 2 years of diet fatigue, if you can even stick to it that long, go for it. But I know most people want to get in and out of fat loss phases as fast as possible. And when I mentioned that, I meant that that's typically someone that has a lot of weight to lose. But most people listening to this, well, most people that come to me don't have 80 pounds to lose. It's usually around the 30 mark or the 20 mark, or just people that have that little 3 to 5 pounds left to lose. It's not fat loss that you need there. You need to be patient in the process, and the more time that you spend learning to maintain, the better. So thank you so much for bringing that last part in. And I kind of want to bring your wife back into this, because there's a lot of people that follow me that are in their 40s and in their 50s, and they think that menopause, they think that aging is sabotaging their results. They think that nutrition and training changes as you age, because if you, let's just say, calorie deficit doesn't work. That's pretty much the idea that a lot of people are thinking. But the hardest thing to accept is that it is so much harder to build muscle. And if you've spent the past 20 years of your life trying to lose fat, trying to shrink down, and you haven't spent enough time trying to build muscle, it is going to be harder. Let's emphasize that part and how fat does shift to different areas, but how you can actually change it so you can be successful in terms of how you approach it now moving forward, because she only just started not that long ago.
Yeah. Dude, okay, so menopause involves profound physiological changes, yes, but that time period in people's life from their mid-40s to mid-50s, that is also arguably the most hectic and stressful times personally and professionally in people's lives. And so what happens during that time period while menopause is happening is they are also dealing with professional stress and personal stress, family members, friends, co-workers, sons, daughters, everything from every angle is happening to people in that phase of middle age. And what people tend to do in that time of their lives is they tend to use food as an escape. They tend to use food as medication. They tend to use food as entertainment from boredom. And so really, and it's not just food that people really indulge in. There's also alcoholic beverage intake to escape the stresses of life. Oh my goodness, my son is going to college. Or oh my goodness, my son or my daughter just got fired from her job. She has to move back home and live with me. Holy crap, give me that wine. So there's a number of things. And sometimes people, generally speaking, at that point in their lives, their habits are so deeply ingrained. By the time you're in your mid-40s, mid-50s, your habits are super duper hard to break. So the process of undoing maladaptive conditioning is sometimes it's the hardest part of working with the perimenopausal, postmenopausal population. And so while I will grant you that body fat gain in terms of where it's stored distribution wise, patterning wise, yes, it does seem to shift. Body fat storage seems to be greater in the abdominal region than it was when you're a spring chicken, when you're a homecoming queen or a college cheerleader, right? It is different. However, you still have control of how much body fat you accumulate, and you still have control of what you do in terms of maintaining and or building muscle. So true, if you were to become overweight or obese in middle age as somebody who's peri or postmenopausal, there will be more abdominal fat, but you can still reduce it by using that pretty much the same damn rules as somebody at any age. So there's no special formula for the menopausal body fat storage pattern. There's no special diet for it other than the fundamentals, which is making sure you get enough protein and making sure the diet's sustainable, making sure the diet's healthy, making sure that you are consuming a protein or rather a carbohydrate and fat proportion that you can personally sustain. And that is also conducive to your personal goals. I think that there's this big myth that menopause comes with an automatic gain in abdominal fat. And this is only true for the typical Western lifestyle pattern where people's physical activity creeps down, their sedentary behavior creeps up, and their tendency to overconsume food, use it as medication, overconsume alcohol, and let food become sort of this medication against stress. I think those types of patterns are what coincide with that age bracket and make people think, oh boy, I am doomed to the menopausal belly. But that's just not true.
And I guess this dispels the myths that hormone coaches and holistic coaches trying to sell their special menopausal programs put out there. Yeah. So I love the fact, because I really wanted you to bring in that alcohol part as well. How can this be such a massive setback more than usual for especially as our hormones change, for women as they age?
There's a couple of different pathways towards adverse effects. And one of them would be the way that alcohol acts upon disinhibition. So the effort factor, you know, where you have less discretion and you less care about what you eat. and what's in front of you. You just kind of say, oh, screw it. I'm just going to eat it. And this is a tendency when people are intoxicated. So if you can kind of imagine like showing up at the Waffle House at 2 a.m., you're starving, you had a few drinks, and you will have a much greater tendency to overeat these hyperpalatable, unproductive types of foods, more so than you would have if you didn't drink. So that there's the disinhibition or the effect of alcohol. And then there is another effect that's highly underestimated, and that is the negative effects of alcohol or excessive alcohol intake on sleep. So alcohol can decrease the quality of your sleep, and it can decrease the quantity of your sleep. And if that happens, then not only can that impact your training output, but it can also impact your appetite levels through the day. So if you lack sleep, once again, your body gets defensive, senses some sort of a survival threat, some sort of an energy crisis, and you will be much more hungry and have a much more intense level of cravings if you chronically lack sleep, and alcohol can facilitate that lack of quality sleep. And then, of course, there's the calories within the beverages themselves that are adding to this phenomenon. Further down the line, if somebody truly is abusing alcohol, then the next day hangover effect can prevent any kind of training or any kind of real movement at all. And so your exercise activity goes down as a result of the hangover. Your non-exercise activity goes down as the result of the hangover. Your cravings are increased. And it's just a big cluster jam of issues as a result of alcohol intake. And everybody is different in terms of how they respond to alcohol intake. Everybody's different. There are some people who, after one drink, they're like, that's enough. I'm done. Put it down. Go on with their lives. There's other people who are like, okay, a couple drinks, not really feeling the buzz. Let's go for a third one. All right, I'm beginning to get their fourth one, fifth one. And so it just kind of ranges, you know? And so you never know what kind of person you are in terms of your response to alcohol unless you start the habit. And so that's why there is an inherent level of risk in starting the drinking routine. And that's just because statistically at the general population level, about 10% of the general population, literally one in 10 people in any given room, has some degree of out of control drinking habits. They have some degree of alcohol use disorder. And that's the alarming statistic amongst the general public in the developed world. That one in 10 people have an issue with alcohol.
I have one more topic after alcohol, but I do want to say you don't know how much easier your process and results can be when you give up alcohol, because most people are drinking it before bed, and alcohol before bed, like you said, it sedates you and your quality goes down. So you might be clocking up the hours in bed, but they aren't good ones, and that's going to impact so much more. And come on, like, as you age, muscle synthesis is already lower. You're already finding it harder to lose fat, to build muscle. Don't make it worse. Do our elimination pathways also slow down as we age, or is that also individual?
It's individual, but things tend to, at the general population, everything kind of gets worse as we age. But people who proactively institute healthy habits and routines, obviously they'll have the best outlook as far as health span and preventing and delaying these negative processes.
I just love the fact you said health span there, because people are so obsessed with health span and natural and organic, yet they drink alcohol more often than not and fill themselves with freaking pre-workouts and, oh my God, take my supplements. Oh, but eat natural. But that was the digression. the last topic I want to cover, which kind of can help with the last topic, but just in general, what exactly is the science behind collagen in terms of everything and anything, because it's not going to be conducive to muscle growth, but there is a lot being said about collagen.
Yeah, collagen, if you can think about it as, okay, so collagen is to connective tissue in the body, ligaments, tendons, joints, skin. Those are high collagen tissues. Even bone is, a third of bone is collagen. So if you can think of it like that, and you can sort of look at collagen being analogous to calcium and the skeleton. So our skeletons are mostly calcium. And so if you have a low consumption of calcium, you're going to run into issues with skeletal health. Now, collagen, the body has a certain capability of biosynthesizing it. But there is enough research showing that when we consume collagen, then we can actually impact non-muscle lean tissue. So muscle tissue, skeletal muscle tissue is only like 5% connective tissue, whereas joint tissue and ligaments is the majority of it is going to be collagen. And the argument against collagen, when people tell you to never take collagen because it's useless, because it's a low quality protein, etc., and typically they'll say that whatever protein you consume, the body takes the amino acids that it needs and puts those amino acids where they need to go. So it doesn't matter. You know, what you might as well go for whey because it's got more essential amino acids than collagen. And then they'll further say, if you look at head-to-head comparisons of collagen versus whey, then whey always has a more anabolic effect in muscle tissue compared to collagen. Yeah. Okay, so the counterpoint to that is, A, there are plenty of studies showing that collagen intake improves non-muscle tissue related outcomes, and it improves joint outcomes, skin outcomes, connective tissue outcomes in general. And this is seen in multiple studies to the point where there are multiple meta-analyses and systematic reviews showing that the stuff works for those outcomes. Okay, now, the response to saying, you might as well take whey does the same thing as collagen because your body takes the constituent amino acids, grabs them, puts them where they need it. Okay, well, that's not true because whey is not a particularly good source of proline and glycine, which are the foundation of connective tissue building. When you consume collagen, if you can bear with me here, when you consume collagen, the dye and tripeptides, or the collagen fragments, they stay intact even when they reach blood circulation, and they make their way into joint tissue and stimulate the activity of the chondrocytes, or the joint cells. And so this is something that is unique to collagen intake. And this isn't something that you would see if you just downed a whole bunch of whey, for example. And so mechanistically, it makes sense. You're just simply providing the raw materials for building that particular tissue. Just like if you were to consume calcium-rich foods, if you wanted to build your bones, why not consume collagen-rich foods, or hey, even supplement with collagen to support connective tissue, joints, skin, ligaments, tendons. So the research is there to support, at the very least, the potential of benefit from collagen consumption. But when you think of it in terms of all you're doing is just providing the raw materials for the actual tissue itself, then it makes sense. It makes sense. But you know what? The research is there. And so I'm not one of these guys who's going to say, collagen doesn't work. Nah, you just take in whey, because guess what, man? The research does not indicate or support that position.
I love this because it's collagen does not work for building muscle. But that's not why we're taking collagen. It's like you need to know the intended purpose behind what it is you're taking. And that's why I say collagen doesn't count as your protein source in terms of wanting the anabolic response. But collagen is used in athletes to help their injury recovery. It's used in wound healing, I think, in burn victims and other people that, like, just any wound in general, because that skin, that's connective tissue, especially as you age, it can play a role, because as you age, collagen production decreases, but more isn't better. So know why you're taking a supplement. Taking collagen in the morning as your 35 gram dose of protein is probably not conducive to your goals of let's stimulate this anabolic response. It's not going to do that, but it will help with, like Alan said, connective tissue. Is there anything else you wanted to add on to what I just said?
Yeah, there's a scarcity of studies comparing whey versus collagen, or collagen versus some sort of popular, you know, in quotes, high quality protein for connective tissue outcomes, for joint outcomes, for skin outcomes, for tendon and ligament outcomes. There's almost no research comparing whey versus collagen, for example, for that purpose. But why would they do that anyway? I mean, I'm not going to hold my breath for that kind of research. Yeah. So I will admit that there is some gray area there. For all I know, hey, we could do 5 studies in a row comparing whey versus collagen for, let's say, some sort of joint or tendon or ligament related outcome. And then let's imagine whey performs just as good as collagen for all of that stuff across a replication of studies. Well, then I would admit, I'd go, oh, well, heck, apparently the body can assemble collagen just fine from high quality non-collagen proteins in the diet. But as things stand, it doesn't make biologically plausible sense that that would be the case.
That's that, like you literally stated it before. The amino acids in animal protein, in any other plant protein, it doesn't have hydroxyproline. It doesn't have glycine. It doesn't have the constituents of what make up collagen. So yeah, okay, take both, but more isn't better. More protein is better in my eyes, but more collagen doesn't give you more collagen production outcomes. So.
Yep. And you know what? If all else fails, just say, look at my beautiful skin. Come on. Just appeal to your own authority, you know, appeal to your own looks.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. Ugh, so much goodness. I did want to touch on ice baths, but maybe you can just give a quick summary on ice baths because I'm so sick of them. And then we can have you tie up the podcast with a bow.
Did you say ice?
Ice baths. Ice baths.
Oh, dang. You know, your accent was so epic that I actually flew over my head. Okay, so...
Just like a little bow knot there, because again, it's something that's just been overblown, and just to like lay the science facts there before we.
Yeah, sure, sure. So ice baths.
That is great.
I can't do it, man. Ice baths. The way that, yeah, I love it. Okay. So
I have to listen to it again.
Well, ice baths. Yeah. Let's talk about ice baths
here. On the rodeo.
So, yeah, you know, let me tell you about taking ice baths in my day. They literally, and not figuratively, inhibit muscle hypertrophy and strength gains. So if you're somebody, if you're an athlete, recreational or competitive, and your number one priority is, let's say, muscle size gains or muscle size and or strength gains, ice baths antagonize that goal. And it's because they antagonize the pathways to that goal. They lower angiogenesis. They lower They're actually vasoconstricting rather than a vasodilating thing. They lower blood flow. They lower muscle protein synthesis. They lower anabolic signaling. So all of those things combined equals a compromise in maximal rates of muscle size and strength gain. So if you have those goals, then doing ice baths makes no sense. Okay, now let's take a different scenario where you're an endurance athlete. There are some data showing that ice baths can benefit. And it's just a whole different game, a whole different set of imposed demands. And so there seems to be a divergence there of the benefit for ice baths and size strength related goals versus endurance goals. As far as all the longevity speculations of ice baths, that's just a bunch of hopes and wishes and hogwash and
quackery.
I mean, if you enjoy getting in that ice bath, if you genuinely enjoy it, you think it fires you up, you think it wakes you up, if you feel like it gives you some sort of psychological benefit, like you're a building character somehow, then do it. It's not going to hurt you. It's not really going to hurt anybody. Unless your main goal in life is to gain as much size and strength as possible. And here's the funny thing about that, Ruby. Chris Bumstead, who nobody can argue with his his physique, he's a dunker. He dunks himself. But sometimes with athletes, it's a matter of succeeding in spite of their ritual.
I was just about to say that.
Rather than because of their rituals. And so, that's my short take on ice baths.
I love that. And if you go back through my podcast and find my very first podcasts with Tom Brainbridge, we kind of picked apart so many of Tom Huberman's, Andrew Huberman's podcasts on this very thing, saying, if you want to wake up, wash your face with cold water. But like, if you want longevity, I suppose I'm going to do that. It's just the whole stress thing. Why don't you just do training? Why don't you just eat healthy? But yeah, and on the endurance athletes, just to tie bow on that one, I got one of my clients to take an ice bath the other day. But why? Because she has a triathlon this weekend and her training was really hard. And we wanted to reduce muscle damage, and you need muscle damage to grow muscles. But it is not conducive when you have a triathlon that dooming weekend and you need to recover in time for it and you don't want to have sore muscles. Yeah. With that, is there anything else that you want to plug below? I'm going to have the Alan Aragon below. Are there any leaving messages?
I just want to commend your audience for following you, having the vision and the brains to follow an evidence-based champion like yourself, Ruby. So thank you all. And thank you all for tuning in. And yeah, just a plug for my baby, my research review, which is a monthly newsletter, which costs pennies, but it keeps you on top of the latest information. And so it's really something that I insist that professionals are subscribed to. But if you're just a lay person and you have enough interest in the science of things, I think that you can benefit too. So that's it.
Yeah. Check Alan's link in his bio for the link to that as well. And that's kind of the reason why I am so evidence-based, because back in 2018, I think that's when I first subscribed to them. I was adamant in trying to understand the research and how to read the research for myself. So give him a follow, give Alan a follow. He's sharing some really golden nuggets as well. And if you haven't already, please read his protein book and his flexible dieting book as well. But just more protein in your life is something that can offset so much of the other stuff, because we tend to overconsume food until we meet our protein. Thank you for listening to this podcast. If you have any other questions for me or for Al, ask them in his messages and he'll get back to you, or send something to me. Share this podcast with someone. See who you can benefit today. If you have any menopausal friends, in particular, I highly suggest you send this podcast to them because it will be very beneficial in helping them see that they aren't doomed and that the hormonal balancing gurus aren't their answer to their questions. So with that,